and decreasing its reliance on Western-dominated international financial institutions. The establishment of ties with Russia, which has been done under a short period of time under the new administration, which has been in power for only 5 months, on the one hand, enabled it to join the SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which covers security and economic spheres. Russia's influence in the Eurasia region and Iran's integration into this region through aligning with Russia will enable it to Iran to stand up to the WTO, which carries the sanction regime policies of the US. Russia has in the meantime reduced its dollar reserves to less than 50%.
Very well, thank you very much for that, we appreciate it. Time for our Info News section, which has been upgraded in the past few weeks in order to expand more on a piece of news that we thought would need more explaining or attention. We hope you like that. First up, the U.S.-Russia crisis. Yes, it's going to affect the world energy prices, in particular oil, as you have seen, which is already seeing prices at around $87 a barrel. And in terms of the Russian economy and how it would cope, well, Russia has reduced the country's exposure to the U.S. dollar, shifted assets out of the U.S., and sold a smaller share of its debt to foreigners. On to our next story, Chinese currency, the yuan. This currency has risen in ranks of top global currencies. It has reached its highest level of popularity in cross-border payments since the year 2015. That means that it is among the world's top five most popular currencies for cross-border payments, securing the fourth spot for the first time in 6 years. Now, this should give the dollar some worries. Moving on to UK inflation. UK inflation, like other parts of Europe, if not the world, has risen. The UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's problems just keep mounting when it comes to, obviously, this on top of the Partygate scandals. But this one hurts more because it has hit a 30-year high, the highest level since 1992. Inflation has hit an annual rate of 5.4% for the month of December. So another problem for the Prime Minister and his administration to deal with on top of the scandals. Finally, we're going to go to what's called Citizens United. But first, let's do a definition check. First, the definition of Citizen United. It was a ruling in the U.S. that unleashed a tsunami of dark money into U.S. politics. This past week marked the 12th anniversary of one of the most destructive rulings ever issued by the U.S. Supreme Court, Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. What has been the outcome of this controversial ruling? Well, the billionaires pumping money, millions of dollars, into the U.S. elections, which worked against Americans and it worked against Main Street. It is something that has plagued U.S. politics for quite some time, and many are against that, because what the billionaires have done is they have rallied politicians to have their back as opposed to the Americans and everyday people there in the U.S. Well, that does it for our InfoNews section.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
This is our in-depth section. When it comes to Iran's trade, there is a sense that the country is in the cusp of major increases in its volume worldwide. Now, let me explain why that there is a consensus to that effect. First comes Russia. New agreements were made with Russia. The current volume of annual trade exchanges between Iran and Russia, which stands roughly at around $4 billion, some estimates say three, roughly, however, $4 billion is what we have, will increase to at least $10 billion. That's projected. Russian oil companies have announced that they plan to make investments in Iran's oil fields according to the new agreements. Let's not forget also the 20-year Russia agreement, which foreign ministers of both countries have announced that they are working on. Now comes the plans for Iran's membership at the Eurasian Economic Union. It's called the EEU. But we're going to take a look at that in the context of Russia's annual imports. Russia's annual imports are $200 billion. That's within this union and outside of it. If Iran has a share of that, of at least 10% of the $200 billion in Russia's annual imports, well, a major development will take place in the economic sector for Iran. The Russian president had said that Iran should reap the benefits of trade that exists in the EEU. And these are some of the countries that are, not some, but all the countries that are a member at this point. And that's how Iran could reap the benefits of being part of that union.
There is also a provisional agreement that regulates Iran's relations with EURASEC, the Eurasian Economic Commission, and we are proactive in creating a lasting foundation for creating a free trade area between Iran and the Eurasian Economic Union.
Wow, a free trade area is something that I neglected to include in this section. And that's a big deal. That actually will lead to Iran having more in its trade with that union. Now, next up, we're going to talk about Iran's membership at the SCO, which happened recently. SCO is major, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, 3/5 of the Eurasian continent, 40% of the world population, and 20% of the world's GDP is in this Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So obviously the numbers speak for themselves. Now, China's trade is $258.8 billion when you take a look at its overall trade that is in this organization. Iran's trade is $28 billion. So you can see how small Iran's trade is relative to China's. And then again, Iran can reap the benefits now that it's a member to increase that volume of $28 billion. All right, now we're going to take a look at the Iran-China annual trade between the two, bilateral trade that happens. What are we looking at? Well, 2018, it went up to roughly around $40 billion from what I'm saying, a little bit more than that. Let's take a look at the average here. So a little bit over $40 billion for 2018. 2019, roughly around $40 billion, a little less. And then 2020, it went down, and 2021, it has come up to around $60 billion. It seems like $50 to $60 billion is the bilateral trade, more or less, but on the rise. And now that the Iran-China 25-year agreement is in its implementation stage, well, things can only get better. Why mention these facts? Well, let's take a look at the reasons behind that. Iran is actually capitalizing on its Asia-centered policy, which will involve de-dollarization. Now, that's something that Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, has said. He has said Iran has three top priorities: a neighbor-centered policy, an Asia-centered policy with a focus on looking to the east, and an economy-centered diplomacy. Okay, let's find out what our guests think. Rejoining us for this section is Dmitry Babich, radio host and political commentator. All right, Dmitry Babich, welcome back. Iran already enhancing its ties, obviously, with countries like Russia, like China, and also becoming a member at the SCO, which is a big deal after being a permanent member for quite some time. Do you think that the U.S. hostile policies has actually alienated the U.S. on the one hand while pushing countries like Russia, China, and Iran together?
Yes, so the United States simply left no choice to Iran, Russia, and China but to cooperate. We might have longer periods of, I would say, uncertainty between our three countries unless the United States acted so resolutely.
Okay, Dmitry Babich there talking. Let me now turn my attention to Ruhollah Madaber, who's here in the studios with us. Ruhollah Madaber, you heard our guests over there, and basically I'm going to come at you with another angle, and that was something that the Russian president actually spoke to Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, at the Kremlin, and that was regarding the successful relationship between Iran and Russia when it came to Syria. Obviously, the union there and the cooperation led to lots of successes for that country. And my question to you is, won't this type of cooperation go against U.S. interests and for then the U.S. to try to prevent Iran and Russia to cooperate on different issues when it comes in the region, in particular, obviously, when it comes to economic transactions between the two?
An important strategy point that was made by the Russian President Vladimir Putin in the three-hour conversation that he had with Iranian President Raisi at Kremlin, and Mr. Putin's personal result-oriented personality was made at the beginning of the conversation after sending his greeting to Iran's leader. It was about the successful experience that Iran and Russia had when it came to Syria. But it had to do with the Shahid Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani recommendation and his anti-terrorism fight, something that Iran and Russian Federation continued against these Daesh terrorists. This successful cooperation was so important that the Russian president in the meeting with the Iranian president Raisi repeated this again. This successful cooperation between the two also poses a problem for the U.S. because ever since the Cold War, the most important issue for the bankrupt U.S. is that good relation is not developed between its adversaries, especially now that the Islamic Republic is experiencing hard-hitting sanctions. Iran's military and navy has become so strong. Recently, there were massive navy drills that took place between Russia, Iran, and China, which showed that Iran's navy has reached such a strength that it can serve as being protector of these very important and strategic waterways.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. I wish we had more time. Ruhollah Mudabbar in the studio with us, expert on Eurasia, Russian Federation affairs. Many thanks for joining us here and on Economic Divide.
Iran has had two major developments recently that will affect trade volume tremendously. Let's first take a look at the 20-year agreement that Iran and Russia have announced. The announcement was made by Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, who said the Iranian and Russian presidents have tasked their foreign ministers to work out a roadmap for cooperation over the next two decades. What is misunderstood here is that it's not a new agreement, but one that is being updated. In 2001, Iran and Russia signed a 10-year cooperation agreement, mainly in the nuclear field, that was extended to 20 years through 2 5-year extensions. The 20-year agreement, discussed by Mr. Putin and Mr. Raisi, focuses on technology transfers from Russia, the purchase of Russian military equipment, and Russian investment in Iranian energy infrastructure. Which brings us to the next agreement, one that Iran and China have signed, a 25-year agreement, one that has now reached the implementation stage. Iran has said the Russia-Iran agreement would actually be modeled after this accord. It's been described as a sweeping deal that includes economic, security, and military cooperation. It is reported that China will invest in a wide range of projects in Iran, such as oil, gas, and petrochemical industries. One of the key provisions is noteworthy, creating a special mechanism to aid banking transactions between the two countries in the Chinese currency, the yuan, and working to make Iran the center point of China's Silk Road's commercial route in West Asia. Remember, an official release of all these details has not been done, so any provisions can't be confirmed. But with the U.S. sweeping sanctions on Russia and China, with the most intensive sanctions on Iran as well, the three countries are keen to unite as a bulwark against the U.S. hegemony. Okay, that's the end of this segment of the program. Hope you liked it. If you have any questions or comments, please send it to us. From me, Mahdi, it's goodbye until next week's program.
Well, it's time for our parting thoughts here. We dedicated two shows to this topic, Iran and the occasion of Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi's visit to Russia. Why did we do that? The reason is because for the first time in a very long time, the U.S. foreign policy has aligned Iran, Russia, and China's economic and foreign policy objectives against the U.S., which has acted belligerently against these nations, from military threats to sanctions to the weaponization of the dollar. Russia and China now have no doubt about the U.S. hostile intentions against them, something that Iran has been dealing with for decades. That does it for this edition of the program. We do appreciate it if you send us your comments and questions, especially on this program. We would love to hear from you. From Mika Vitahwey and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. This is the gas. I filled my car and don't need to go to gas station for about a week. To be honest, I hate the smell of gas. Makes me feel bad. The oil and petrochemical products may remind many of Iran, though I particularly remember the city of Abadan in southwestern Iran, which its name is mingled with oil and oil refinery. Actually, today we are going to take a trip to Abadan in order to visit an amazing museum. Yes, Benzinkhane Museum, literally Gasoline House Museum. The first gas station in Iran was established at the center of the city of Abadan by British Petroleum Company in 1927. This site was initially used as a place for selling and distributing kerosene, though after a time, and by the import of cars to Iran, this site changed into a gas station. Earlier, fueling was done by manual pumps and then sold to customers. Benzinkhane Museum of Abadan, with an area of 1,856 square meters, is located in proximity of a new gas station in this city. The main building of the museum holds the documents, papers, and objects related to the gas station, including pumps, measurements, tins, and other devices which have been put on display. There are also two other minor buildings in the area, one used for exhibiting all the documents related to the distribution of petrochemical products in the country, and the other one used for the convenience of the visitors. I am now at Abadan Airport. I just got off the plane. The humid weather and the special scent of this city, which comes from petrochemical products. These two features tell me that I am in the city of Abadan. I love this city. I am now at Benzinkhane Museum of Abadan. At the main gate of the museum, there is a sign which reads, "The first gas station of Iran." Let's go inside the area of the museum. Such a pretty area. Oh, wow, palm trees. Eucalyptus trees and bougainvillea bushes have all made a very beautiful scenery. I am now at the western part of the area of the museum. Here, there is a collection of gas station equipment, each organized according to the year of its production and completion process. Oh, look. This is a glass manual pump. The sign next to it says, "This pump dates back to 1925. And here there are 12 systems made in Britain, US, Japan, as well as Germany, Australia, and India. Oh my god, this is amazing! Here there is a gas station dating back to 1927, which is actually reconstructed. It's a brick-made building, which has a sign in Farsi and old fonts that reads, "The Center for Selling Homemade Products." And on the other side, there is an advertisement which reads, "Just use the pure parse gas." And here, there is an old red Opel car, which is reconstructed, actually. This car is put in front of a replica of one of the oldest gas station systems in the world. There is also a replica of a gas station worker dressed in uniform, filling a car. It's made creatively. Oh, I completely feel I have traveled to 1927, though I wasn't born at that time. I am now in another hall of the museum. In this hall, there are domestic and industrial devices which work with petrochemical products, as well as banknotes and stamps related to the oil industry. There are also different types of lamps, kerosene lamps and kerosene stove. Remind me of my grandma's old house. And on the walls, there are old black and white photos. In this old photo, you can see men and women standing in a queue waiting for oil. Oh, look at here. There are different types of graduated measurements and 20-liter tins special for carrying fuel and petrochemical products. I was wondering how hard life was at those times. If you happen to visit Benzinkhane Museum of Abadan, look at the newspaper ads in this museum. I'm sure the old photos and writings which advertise oil make you feel excited.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United States military has come under intense scrutiny over its procedures to guard against civilian casualties after a high-profile mistaken drone strike in Kabul, Afghanistan, that claimed the lives of 10 civilians, including 7 children, on August 29. The U.S. military initially said it successfully targeted a Daesh terrorist who was linked to the attack on the Kabul airport that killed over 100 people, including 13 U.S. troops. The latest study by the RAND Corporation think tank concluded that systemic weaknesses at the Department of Defense were resulting in it falling short of its duties on civilian casualties. It added that in conflicts, the U.S. military's access to targeted areas is limited both before and after strikes, and it relies on intelligence gathered remotely using sources like drone surveillance and satellite imagery.
Well, the United States regularly violates its own and international laws about related to war, but I do think the U.S. needs to completely reevaluate its use of drones entirely. We know because of brave whistleblowers like Daniel Hale and other journalists who have reported on drones and drone use that the U.S. often uses faulty intelligence to conduct these strikes, which do result in lots of civilian casualties.
The RAND study, which was required by congressional legislation, found that the problem is compounded by the U.S. military when it fails to adequately talk to people from outside the U.S. government or armed forces who might have access to information on the ground. After the RAND study was released, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin issued a memorandum calling for the creation of a plan on civilian harm mitigation and response in the months to come, as well as the creation of Civilian Protection Center later this year. A senior Pentagon official later admitted that the department's data gathering strategies have been faulty and expressed the need to incorporate the figures from other sources in American tallies. The U.S. runs nearly 700 overseas military bases in at least 80 countries around the world. Such widespread military presence means that Washington has been involved in many wars, either covertly or overtly, to secure its interests. Those wars almost always result in many civilian casualties. The question is how the U.S. is planning to reduce the number of civilians who pay the cost of the war on their country with their lives.
Yeah, I think for many reasons the U.S. needs to completely reevaluate its foreign policy. We need to move away from war first and foremost because of the impact it has internationally on countries like Yemen and Afghanistan and other countries the U.S. has been involved in a war inside of in the last few years. Also, the environmental impact of war. War and militarism is driving the climate crisis. And also, we need to do things in the United States, like cut the Pentagon budget to move us away from war and put more money towards things that actually matter, like free healthcare for all Americans and that sort of thing.
That being said, the simplest solution to the problem of civilian casualties overseas seems to be not conducting any such operations in the first place, as the U.S. military's track record in accepting accountability is far from acceptable, and at the same time, the countries where the U.S. has deployed troops in are calling for their withdrawal.
Syria's northeastern city of Hasaka is located in a resource-rich part of Syria. The city is not fully controlled by the Syrian government. U.S. troops and their allied Kurdish militants are in control in many key areas here. Hasaka has been the scene of fierce clashes between Daesh terrorists and members of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces over the past week. Chaotic scenes first erupted on January 20th when a large group of Daesh terrorists launched a surprise assault on the Gueran prison in Hasaka. They were trying to help thousands of their comrades to escape from the prison. Daesh terrorists used explosive-laden cars to force their way into the prison, triggering a major jailbreak. They also seized weapons and took over several cell blocks. Following days of battles and many American airstrikes, Kurdish militants said they managed to fully recapture the detention facility after the assailants inside the prison gave up. The brazen assault was the latest reminder of increasing Daesh activities in Syria. When this latest episode in Hasaka was over, the Syrian government reacted to the development. Damascus says what happened in Hasaka this week was in line with American efforts to justify its military presence in different parts of Syria.
The U.S. props up or has some sort of involvement with these terrorist groups, such as the case with Daesh, and then in the same hand wants to say we're going to move in or remain in this country to snuff out this terrorism threat, when that's not really what it's about. The United States just wants to have the appearance of being concerned about stopping terrorism, but in reality it seems like the U.S. is the one who's the most prominent in propping them up.
Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations stressed that the recent events in Hasaka require the UN Security Council to act. Sabah called on the Council to work toward putting an end to the presence of U.S. forces in northeastern Syria and the southern Al-Tanf region. He also demanded the U.S. halted support for the Kurdish-led SDF and terrorist groups and its plunder of Syria's natural resources and assets. Sabah echoed comments by Syria's president's political and media advisor, Butina Shaban. She said in December that the U.S., under the guise of its anti-terrorism mission, intervened in Syria, occupied parts of the country, and plundered its resources like oil and natural gas. When Daesh began seizing large parts of Iraq and Syria in 2014, the U.S. was widely accused of involvement in the creation of the terrorist group. Some even inside the United States, like former President Donald Trump, said that the group was created by the United States. Before coming into office, U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to end America's quote-unquote forever wars. But there are no signs that America intends to pull out the hundreds of its forces in northern Syria who were deployed there without any mandate from the UN or permission from Damascus.
No, Trump was not really that concerned with bringing peace to the Middle East, and Biden is not that concerned with bringing peace either. It's both of them saw the Middle East as a great geopolitical area to destabilize, to ensure that Russia and China have to clean up the mess or help clean up the mess that the United States created.
U.S. officials with knowledge of the Biden administration's plans say that the U.S. will not be pulling out of northeastern Syria anytime soon.
Mali's government has called on Denmark to immediately withdraw troops deployed to the West African nation. Malian officials say the reason to ask Copenhagen for the troops' withdrawal is because officials in Bamako were not consulted and the deployment failed to follow protocol. Mali says all troops' deployments in the country need a prior accord with the government before deployments in the African nation. The decision comes amid tension between Mali and regional bodies, and the European Union that have sanctioned Mali after the transitional government failed to organize elections following two military coups.
Danish forces, without identifying themselves to Malian authorities, committed a huge breach in regard to their internal security and also diplomatic relations between the two countries.
About 90 personnel, including sergeants and special forces, and logistics support, were deployed in Mali. Their mandate was supposed to last until early 2023. They were part of Takuba Task Force, which is made up of European special forces. It's based on an initiative by France. Takuba's 900 soldiers are to help Mali's army acquire the combat skills necessary to become self-reliant.
It's a very outrageous situation. I think they are victims of European imperialist intervention. France, which is a former colonial power, intervened 9 years ago, yet the security situation inside the country is far worse than it was in 2013.
A French mission began in Mali in 2013 with the purported aim of countering militants linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorist groups. France is a former colonizer of Africa. It has deployed thousands of soldiers to presumably prevent separatist forces from reaching Mali's capital, Bamako. In December, Paris withdrew from northern Mali and the city of Timbuktu 9 years after launching a war without the initial approval of the United Nations or the French Parliament.
So I do believe that France, you know, has committed grave errors in regard to its intervention in Mali, and
the war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. The withdrawal came amid growing demonstrations against France's military presence in Mali, which has been wracked by two military coups in little over a year.
I think France, you know, because of its colonial history in West Africa, is not able to extricate itself voluntarily. What we've noticed over the last several months, there's been numerous demonstrations against French military presence in Mali and in other West African countries, including Burkina Faso. At the same time, we have a new rash of military interventions and seizures of power in all of these Sahel countries.
France has been one of the world's colonizing countries that, after many years of slavery, still controls countries spread over more than 12 territories and treats their people as second-class citizens. It has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa since 1960, when many of its former colonies gained independence.
Brutality prevails, and that is the imperialist hegemony seeking to extend its influence and maintain its influence internationally.
Mali remains among the poorest countries in the world, but that's not due to a lack of resources. France currently has 5,100 troops in the arid and volatile Sahel region. Under a new plan, they will be reduced to up to 3,000 troops. Analysts say it's premature to call it the end of France's military intervention in Africa, believing Paris is only readjusting its post-colonial plans.
The Yemeni army has launched a massive retaliatory operation against Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the two allies waging war on the country since 2015. It says vital and sensitive targets were accurately struck with drones and missiles.
They targeted the Safra airport. They also hit the Abu Dhabi airport with a big number of ballistic missiles, Zulfiqar. They targeted facilities in the area of Dubai with a big number of drones and unmanned planes of Samad 3. Also, several military posts in the heart of the Saudi area, in the area of Shabra, and other Saudi towns with bigger numbers of a great number of Samad 1 unmanned planes and also artillery fire. They hit very sensitive areas in Jazan and Asir, also with a big number of ballistic missiles.
Sari said the Yemeni army would continue its retaliatory attacks and respond to escalation with escalation. Saudi Arabia and the UAE have both confirmed the retaliatory strikes, but said they intercepted the ballistic missiles. The attack comes just a week after Yemeni forces struck several targets inside the Emirati soil using drones and ballistic missiles.
This war, this conflict has been doomed from the start, from the Saudi and UAE perspective, from the perspective of the coalition, from the perspective of the invaders. There is no chance for them to win. That's why there are several countries that are officially part of this coalition or allies of this coalition who have in reality barely contributed to it because they know there is no point to it.
The strikes are part of the reprisal attacks over the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen, which has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and plunged the country into the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Following Yemen's latest attack on the UAE, the U.S. Embassy and its consular mission in the Emirates advised Americans there to, quote, maintain a high level of security awareness. The statement urges U.S. citizens to take appropriate steps to bolster their personal security. The American Embassy issued a similar alert last week when the UAE was targeted by Yemeni missiles and drones. The Yemeni army is now warning international firms and investors to leave the UAE as the country is insecure and will be targeted as long as it continues its aggression against Yemen. The sheikhdom is now feeling the economic consequences of the attacks. On Monday, the Dubai stock index fell by 2%, while Abu Dhabi stocks closed lower.
This has been very damaging for the economy of the UAE, which is based completely on trade, on commerce, on being a transit hub for both material and non-material trading and products that go around here. That's the only real thing that the country floats on. Without this commercial backing, the country has no future, and they think they know that very well.
Last week, the impoverished nation, was hit by another round of brutal strikes by the Saudi war machine that targeted a prison, claiming dozens of more innocent lives. The Yemenis have shown that the continuous onslaught on their nation won't weaken their resolve to defend their country.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enmity of arrogant powers towards Iran originates from Leather's anti-arrogance and colonialist spirit. This is the part of a televised speech delivered on January 9, 2022, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the anniversary of an uprising by the people of Qom on January 9, 1978.
Fortunately, today, the thoughts and ideas of the pious, dedicated youth are wide-ranging. Fortunately, today we are witness to revolutionary, religious, blossoming, progressive ideas presented by a large number of the youth. On this basis, I wish to raise a number of points. There are many points to be raised, but one cannot speak at length about these points in these meetings, so I will only mention several of them. The first point is that, my dear ones, who hear these sentiments from this humble person, you should preserve religious zeal. You must preserve it. The factor that has saved the country in different times has been the religious zeal of the Iranian nation. It is religious zeal that turns threats into opportunities. An example of this was the imposed war, the 8-year sacred defense, which presented a great threat. But the religious zeal of the people, the religious zeal of the youth, the religious zeal of the fathers and mothers and wives caused our youth to go to the front lines. In that war that was truly global and in which the US, the Soviet Union, NATO and the reactionary forces in the region those days had all joined hands to defeat Iran, bring Imam to his knees and annihilate the movement, it was religious zeal that defeated all of them. This achievement had its base in religious zeal. This was about the role of religious zeal during the sacred defense, but there were other events in subsequent years as well.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In our own time, we can mention the martyrdom of our dear martyr, Martyr Soleimani. The martyrdom of Shahid Soleimani truly turned into a historic, astonishing event. No one thought that tragedy would achieve such greatness and that God, the Exalted, would bless it in such a manner. that it would be able to show the religious and revolutionary identity of the people to everyone in the world. The Iranian nation showed its identity and unity in the true sense of the word when they were carrying the coffin of Shahid Soleimani. Well, funerals were held for him in Tehran, in Kerman, in Tabriz, Mashhad, and various other cities in Iran. An enormous funeral was held for him in Iraq too. If that martyr's holy body had been taken to Syria and Lebanon, the same things would have happened there as well.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Islamic and national forces in the Gaza Strip held a rally near the separation fence between Gaza and the occupied lands. The rally comes to voice the Palestinian outrage of the Israeli apartheid policies of land grabbing. And Naqab is witnessing a wave of forced displacement by Israel's system of apartheid against all Palestinians. Considering these Israeli attempts to expel thousands of Palestinians from their homes and lands a crime against humanity, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip expressed their support to Palestinians in Al-Naqab, south of the country.
The Israeli regime has stolen our land since 1948. Until this moment, it keeps practicing apartheid attempts to take our lands by force. My words for Palestinians in Al-Naqab is that we will always be supported and we are all united in the face of this aggression.
In their speeches, Palestinian factions stressed that the issue of Al-Naqab is the issue of every Palestinian and they won't sit idle in the face of these illegal crimes.
This event is organized by the national and the Islamic forces in Gaza and all the Palestinian tribesmen in order to express our support to our people in Al-Naqab, who are under the Israeli apartheid policies of land grabbing. Israel wants to expel those people from their lands and homes, and this is unacceptable for us. We are together until breaking the Zionist Bennett, who threatened to build an iron wall around our people in Al-Naqab.
Calling it an ongoing Nakba, hundreds of Palestinian citizens demonstrated in Al-Naqab, while dozens of them were arrested by the Israeli regime. The number of Arab citizens in Al-Naqab is estimated at 300,000, living on 5% of the land, of which they said that Israel had confiscated 95% since 1948. Al-Naqab has seen a dramatic escalation as the Israeli regime intensifies its apartheid policies of seizing the Palestinian lands. Palestinians here stress that Al-Naqab is not alone in this struggle. They also say they won't remain silent in this battle against the Israeli crimes. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Mattarella. Mattarella.
After 6 days of failed votes and eight rounds of ballots, on Saturday the Italian parliament re-elected 80-year-old Sergio Mattarella as president of the republic with 759 votes out of 983 cast by the grand electors. In the days ahead of the election, Mattarella, who has been in office since 2015, had repeatedly said that he didn't want another stint. However, he changed his mind on Saturday afternoon when the leaders of parliamentary groups resorted to him in a desperate attempt to put an end to a political impasse that would erode the nation's credibility. The political stalemate was triggered by parties' disagreement over the candidacy of Prime Minister Draghi to be the next president earlier in the week. In the following days, parties struggled to reach an agreement over an alternative figure, dragging the country on the verge of a political crisis. Commentators have slammed political leaders for their bickering over a consensus candidate. Some have said that not even during a pandemic crisis which has brought the country to its knees, political parties have been able to put aside their differences. Prime Minister Draghi is expected to reshuffle his cabinet as his first move following Mattarella's election. He has to make sure that the 260 billion euros that Italy is receiving from the European Recovery Fund to counter the economic fallout of the COVID-19 crisis are spent effectively. Draghi has committed to 58 reforms and 132 investments over the next 5 years. Max Civili, Rome.
Cheering for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, thousands of locals in southern Damascus welcomed high-ranking security officers who arrived in Kiswe town to initiate a reconciliation process that would lead to providing amnesty to those wanted by security apparatus during the crisis and implementation of presidential amnesty decrees.
There's an amnesty decree by President Bashar al-Assad today to start a reconciliation campaign in the countryside. Tomorrow, the campaign will cover all Damascus countryside for all misled Syrians. The importance of such a campaign is its contribution in restoring peace.
We conveyed the demands of the people in Damascus countryside for reconciliation to President Assad, who ordered the formation of a security committee that includes the military prosecution and all security apparatus to solve the problems of the people and settle their situation.
Hundreds of wanted people flocked to reconciliation centers to settle their situation. Some had escaped military duty, while others were involved in anti-government acts or were members of armed groups in the past.
We were outlaws. We came to reconcile. We were misled like many Syrians. Everyone makes mistakes. We came today to be on the right track with our homeland thanks to President Assad.
This is the most comprehensive reconciliation deal south of the capital. Over 2,700 individuals had reconciled in southern Damascus since 2016. Thousands more currently have the chance to return to normal life in the next week. The Syrian government has for years prioritized reconciliation deals over military solutions in areas that have witnessed violence throughout the unrest. Such deals lay the foundation for negotiated settlement of the crisis facing the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip held a sit-in in solidarity with Palestinians in the Negev. The event was held in the east of Gaza by Palestinian resistance factions. In recent days, the Israeli regime launched violent attacks in the Negev to evict Palestinians from their villages. Palestinians view Israeli attacks in the Negev as a continuation of the 1948 Nakba, when Palestinians were forcibly displaced from their homes during the creation of the Israeli regime.
This criminal entity will never succeed in stealing our land. Destroying the villages will not break the will of our people in the Negev. As we stand here, we say to the enemy that we will defend the Negev, like we defend all Palestinian lands.
Tens of thousands of Palestinians in the Negev suffer from continuous displacement attempts in order to uproot them from their land and homes. Every year, hundreds of Bedouin homes are razed to the ground as part of the Israeli regime's settlement expansion projects in the Negev. Hamas has called for unity among all Palestinians to fight Tel Aviv's expansionist policies.
We stand in solidarity with our brothers in the Negev who are being subjected to ethnic cleansing and apartheid. The Israeli regime is a racist regime, and we will not sit idle as it attacks our people in the Negev. By attending this event, we are sending a message of unity to all Palestinians against the crimes of the Israeli regime.
The Islamic Jihad movement accused Arab regimes who normalized ties with Tel Aviv of encouraging Israeli attacks against Palestinians.
Normalization by some Arab regimes has given the Zionist enemy the green light to commit